Creates Art Podcast. Discussion of protest and political art. Hello, friends. This is Timothy Kim O'Brien, head instigator of Create Art Podcast, bringing you 20 years of arts experience in various disciplines to help you create more than you consume. Today, we're going to be talking about political and protest art. And we have on the air with us Christopher Sims, an old friend of mine from way back in the day. We're going to be talking about how he started in poetry and rap, and then continue on with how he got to political art. So sit back and enjoy. Speaking about creativity, Gagglepod is our network sponsor. You can find more on Gagglepod at gagglepod.com. And that's where we help creatives tell their story through the power of podcasting. Kyle Bondo and I have been doing this since 2016, and we've helped numerous podcasters present their stories to you, our audience. Our flagship show is Podrect, and you can find out about Podrect at podrect.com or go to gagglepod.com. And at Podrect, we help you survive your podcast. Now, let's go ahead and hear a little bit from Chris and his journey. Get into poetry. What's your first delving into poetry?
It was around 1985. I had heard some early hip-hop rap music, and I got immediately excited, and the light went off in my head, and I knew that's what I wanted to do. So I get to Haskell Elementary School shortly after that, and I started writing little rhymes, raps with the young fellows there, especially who were doing the same. And that was the rap part, but in the late 90s is when I really got into writing poems and spoken word. It was around 1997. And in 98, I wound up in Memphis, Tennessee, where they had open mic spoken word venues. And I quickly got involved in the scene in Midtown and downtown Memphis, Tennessee. Sweet. And then went back home to Rockford. And yeah, that's when it all really took off.
And I think that's when I ran into you is, I think we were at a Borders poetry reading. And I think you were there and doing some poetry readings, either at Barnes & Noble's or Borders, one of those. Mm-hmm. Because Rockford is not necessarily known as a hotbed of poetry. However, I happen to know that you were part of a great team in Rockford there, the Poetic Justice League of America. Many years ago, and you guys were doing some great stuff down at Mary's pub, doing some great poetry in there. So to kind of fill everybody in here, that's kind of where we get our in the mid to late 2000s, close to 2010 is where we started to hook up. So that's cool. So you got started with hip hop back in the day. Writing raps and all that kind of good stuff. Anybody really stand out for you that really did for you back in that time frame?
Oh, back then, yeah, especially when I got to Haskell and the boom boxes were popular and cassette tapes. So it was Eric B. and Rakim, LL Cool J, Dougie Fresh and Slick Rick. Salt and Pepper came out a little while after that. Dana Dane, rappers like that, KRS-One. When he was Boogie Down Productions, Run DMC, folks like that really inspired me and people who I was really checking for. Oh, even Heavy D and the Boys. I was even listening to them recently, or him rap recently, and all of that old stuff came back. And it really shows me the how much attention I was paying to the lyricism and how I was trying to emulate what they were doing myself.
And when you were writing those raps, what did that do for you? What kind of feelings, emotions, how did that fill your soul into doing what you were doing?
That's a great question. I think I was so exciting, and being able to be brilliant and colorful with words is something that excited me. And being able to be a storyteller, too, that was exciting. So being able to know that you can say so many words in such a time frame and fill it with whatever your imagination could do is what really excited me. It made me feel whole. It made me feel really engaged and involved. And I'm very cerebral. I'm an Aquarius. So it really filled that void too. I could be creative, expressive, and communicative, and people would be and listen or read and be so captivated too. It was really cool.
That, you know, every time I've seen you perform on stage, either live or whenever I catch you through Facebook or what have you, you really do command the stage. I mean, folks, he sounds very smooth and very relaxed at this time. And that's the way he is 24/7. That's, you know, every time I've been around him in person, that's the way I've seen Chris known him as being. But when you take the stage, is there a certain persona that you like to push onto the audience, or is this, hey, you see what you get, and this is all just Chris coming out at you?
I think it's you see what you get for sure, and I know that I've watched people put on a persona before they go on stage, and they use that to command the stage, but really with me is I've embodied everything that you're going to hear that evening or in the daytime or whatever I might be doing. So I'm bringing my whole self, but I've thought a lot about it too. And even with recording videos these days, I'm moving the camera around to get different shots of myself being expressive, but it's really what you see is what you get. But I've been doing it for a long time, so I have a lot of control over what I'm saying and doing, which feels really good.
You've gone to a lot of different venues, and you've gone to a lot of different areas around the country. Obviously, based out of Rockford, and it started in Rockford, but like you said, you've gone to Memphis, and you've been to other cities across the country. Where are you finding that people are most receptive, the most receptive audiences? They're ready to hear what you have to say.
At the top of the list is New York City. Yeah. And I'm fortunate that I'm working with some people out of Brooklyn right now, putting on an event, and we're convening and talking about poetry and all of that, working together. But I did a tour in New York City in 2008 at a publicist who helped me set that up. She did most of the work. So when I get there, I mean, man, they were, you know, they beat me there. You know, they were ready and hungry. I was in East Harlem. I was in Brooklyn. And, yeah, they were really hungry for it. So at the top of the list is New York City. And even if I'm doing something online right now, you know when New York City or Brooklyn or Harlemite folks are there, because they're very engaged and they really want to hear what you have to say. So New York City, Connecticut, I did a slam poetry feature in New Hampshire. They were super engaged and ready. Massachusetts, they're always ready and willing and very interested. Where else have I been? I don't want to leave anybody out that I know for sure. Missouri, St. Louis area, they've been very willing and ready and wanting to hear what you have to say. Yeah, definitely places like that. Atlanta, gotcha. I was in Atlanta for a conference a couple of years ago. Folks were very ready and willing to listen and to hear what I had to say. So, yeah.
That's sweet, man. That's sweet. So yeah, a lot of the places that you go is ready for this and ready to hear that. Let's talk a little bit about spoken word versus slam poetry. And, you know, we're not going to do a whole, which one is better and that, 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 that. But when you're in a venue that is mainly for spoken word versus when you're in a slam poetry kind of competition thing. So let's say we're at Borders versus the Green Mill in Chicago, which I've been to both and I've had wonderful times at both, but there's a definitely different vibe that I've noticed. How do you prepare for the non-competitive, spoken word thing versus a slam where it is competitive?
Yeah, the slam is so competitive that, yeah, I remember slamming with the Poetic Justice League for America here in Rockford even before we started to venture off. And there was this whole preparation thing. I remember I would be at home, you know, going through even a slam session myself, thinking about, okay, if I need to say this poem here, this poem there, and if I make it to the third round, the final round, and I need to have this poem ready. Whereas with a spoken word venue, I'm thinking about my crowd and who's going to be there and what they might want to hear and what will work well that night. And if there's no stress in it, I'm not stressed out about it or eager or, you know, thinking about numbers and time and all of that. I'm thinking about what spoken word pieces will really rock the crowd or maybe even create some kind of community conversation. So I'm a lot more relaxed when I'm thinking about going to a spoken word venue.
Yeah, nice, nice. I know with me, I do put it on a persona. We were talking about that a little bit earlier about putting on, you don't put on a persona. This is Chris, whether you're sitting in a coffee shop with him, whether he's standing up on stage, he's at a slam, what have you. You get Chris 24/7. With me, you get a little bit of a persona just because I've got a theater background. And I love screwing with audiences like that. That's just the way I am. I just love screwing with audiences. But with the slam versus a spoken word kind of piece, yeah, I think the preparation is different, and it can kind of be more self-focused on the artist at a slam versus the audience that has come to see you. I mean, with Green Mill, I'm counting how many times I can drop an F-bomb, and I can kind of figure out, okay, well, if I drop it here, here, and here, I can get probably a 7 or an 8 and worry about my score. Whereas if I'm, sitting at Borders, or I don't even think they have Borders anymore. I think they all closed down. But if I'm sitting in a nice coffee shop or something like that, doing a spoken word, I might go, you know what, I don't need to drop that F-bomb here for effect. I can come up with something wittier or more profound than going to a cheap hit and maybe get a better conversation out of that. Speaking about doing the spoken word thing and all that, how many do you get into? Do you find that the audience is getting into conversations with you afterwards a lot of the time?
They are, yeah. We definitely have conversations, and some people I noticed that it's been their first time at a spoken word event, so they're interested in my craft and my style, and I think I got a piece, I have a few pieces that they date back to with me in the early 2000s that some folks haven't heard that structure or styling that I've used in a spoken word piece, so I think they're really interested in that. And how comfortable I look on stage. So they want to have a conversation. So yeah, I like that. And I get to encourage maybe a younger poet who might be with their sister or brother or mom or father that's there. So those conversations are always cool.
Yeah. And I know a lot of people are almost scared to come up to a poet because they're like, oh, I don't want to bug him or, you know, everyone's up to him. But I don't know. Do you try to make it yourself approachable to all the audience members when you're doing a spoken word event?
I usually do. Yeah, I think I'm always willing to have a conversation, especially about the craft and performance, or how I look at a piece that I might have performed or read that night. So I try to stay open to conversation and dialogue. Only if I feel like I need to be silent afterwards and I don't want too much conversation, I might try to hide or not be open to conversation, but that's rare with me, though.
Yeah, every time I've seen you perform and been around you, you've been very warm to everybody, and you know, there are some times, and again, I'm a poet too, and I'm a spoken word artist, there are some times where, you know, you either don't have the energy, something else is going on, or you read a piece that you're just like, I threw it all out there on the table and I've got nothing more to say about it and I'm done. And, yeah. And you gotta leave it there. And, if you say anything else, you're just going to ruin the piece or ruin yourself or not have the self-care for you, that you need to have to be bold and brave to get up on that stage. Talking about your earlier career, how was it for you to get up on the stage and perform in front of people? How was that for you?
You know what, Tim? I had a teacher at high school elementary school here in Rockford named Dorothy Page Turner. And what was awesome about high school and her, our fifth and sixth grade years, we had a talent show. So she prepared us and myself very early on to be ready for stuff like that. And those talent shows were a big deal because a lot of people showed up. So I was able to perform on that kind of level even when I was in elementary school. So as I've gotten older, I've gotten more comfortable with it. So I'm thankful for Dorothy Page Turner's encouragement and believing in young folks that we could get up on stage and do stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. And do you find that when you talk to younger poets, do you kind of hear what you heard back in the, you know, fifth and sixth grade coming out of your mouth?
Yeah, definitely. They, especially the excitement and being eager and knowing that they found something that maybe not a lot of people encourage them to do, but if they found somebody like me or you, they got that and they were, you know, you see the sparkle in their eyes and they're ready to continue to do more of that in their lives, which is awesome.
I remember, I'm going to sound like an old fogey. Back in the day, and I think you were at this event too, we had Saul Williams at Rock Valley College.
Oh, yeah. You remember that, bro?
Dude, I was the last person in line to get their book signed.
That's right.
And the guy, and I made sure I was last. I was like, I want to talk to him. I took off time to get out, you know, from work to get over here to do this. I'm like, I've got his book in my hand. And I was the last person in line. And I tell you, that guy, he really lays it out there for you. He really puts his soul out there for you. And, it was about an hour after the show has been done. He's talked to us. He's, lectured to us. He's performed for us a few of his pieces. And boom, I'm the last person on there. And he treated me like I was, the first person he's ever met that day. And he and I sat and just rapped a little bit, just talked a little bit. I still got his book right in the back here with him signing it, saying, enjoy the journey, Saul Williams. And I'm like,
nice.
Oh, man. And it was, said the shotgun to the head. That's the book that he wrote that in to me. And I was like, that was fantastic. So, even old hands like us that we've been doing it since, before people were born, we were hatched out of eggs, or whatnot. To have somebody like that, of that level come back to us and give us advice and sit and talk with us, that's where we get a lot of our energy at. So, that's another thing that we share together, man. That's another thing that we share together. That's having awesome. A little family reunion here on Create Art Podcast.
Don't
mind us.
I've told people, who are not even from here or might be new to town that Saul Williams was here some years back at Rock Valley College, and it blows their mind because, dude's huge, and he definitely helped transform the slam poetry scene. So, and he was very humble. You know what I remember, Tim, about that? The Poetic Justice League, we opened up for him that night. So I remember he had just sat down, and I'm watching him. I'm on stage, and I see him in the back of the room. I get off stage, and I did my set. Actually, I think we all got to perform individually, so I got down with my set. And I get down there and saw him sitting in the corner, and he was like, yeah, I really liked your work, bro. I was like, oh, thanks, man. And went and sat down, and that was cool to hear from him.
Yeah. I've seen him in Rock Valley College and Chicago, of all places. I took my nephew, who is a hip-hop artist, and out of Madison, Wisconsin.
Nice.
Who knew that Madison, Wisconsin had a hip-hop a scene, but they do have an underground hip-hop scene. And took him to see him in Chicago. I almost busted my ankle getting to the place. We had a fantastic time. It was weird, though, because he was really almost begging the crowd to go ahead and dance and let loose, because a lot of people were just standing around just to sit and watch him And there's very few people dancing around, and he was making music, and it wasn't a spoken word piece. It was a musical performance. And a lot of the people couldn't, break out of seeing him doing his spoken word and participate in it, because he was really trying to get everyone to join in. And so that was interesting to watch that dynamic with him, you know, him as the musician versus him as the spoken word artist. It was during the Volcanic Sunlight tour that he was doing. Great album. But, you know, you got with him, you got to know, am I going to see spoken word or am I going to go see a concert? And if I'm going to go see a concert, wear comfortable shoes because you're going to be moving around for sure. Mm-hmm. For sure.
Yeah.
Well, to move on a little bit, kind of take a step up, and part of the reason why I wanted you on here tonight is I wanted to talk about political art, protest art, political poetry, protest poetry, because you've been in the scene. You're an activist. I've written a few things, but I have not devoted myself like you have to political works, to have a political bent that you have on that. And I'd like to know for you, okay, so we know in fifth, sixth grade, you're doing rap, starting to do some writing in there for yourself. When did the political side really start to come in for you?
And we're talking about Borders. I remember like it was yesterday. I went to Borders by myself one time. I think it was maybe a few days after the open mic. And I just wanted to get out there and just have some quiet time and to read. And I had a book by Amiri Baraka. And it might have been his collective works. And I read a poem in there called Black Art. And it blew me away, even the way that it was written. So I think not too long after that, I wrote my piece, Poetry That Gives Birth to Revolution. And that was the beginning of my protest poetry, my protest art. So it was then, and that was probably 2002 or 3 or 4. So I've been writing that kind of poetry since then. But in the last 5 years especially, I've been, you know, it's been the bulk of my work. So, but, it, you know, people have requested my voice on stage and at events and whatnot. So I've needed to have those kind of poems written.
That's true. That's true. When you're writing a piece, and this kind of getting into the craft of your writing, are you necessarily, when you write that piece, is it necessarily, hey, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to write a political piece, I'm going to write a protest piece? Or is it, I'm going to write a piece and we're going to see where it takes me? Which is the best, you know, do you sit down and do it that way? And if you can separate that two, which works best for you?
The first way, yeah, because what I've been very focused on is if I hear something that's in the news and I know people are thinking about and they might want to hear it in a poetic form or maybe a spoken word piece, I'll hop right on it. So it's either it's that or I'm thinking about what I need to say in regards to movements and injustice and inequity and all of that. But for sure, I'm usually coming up with my title first, and it's something very political. So as long as I have that title and I'm thinking about what I want to write, you know, then I'm good.
Are you noticing, because I'm noticing ever since I've started hardcore podcasting, especially about art, are you noticing that there are a lot more venues out there for a poet to perform their work versus, you know, back, once again, I'm going to sound like a broken record here, but back in the day when we were in Rockford, there were not a whole lot of venues that we could go to actually perform our pieces for an audience. Are you seeing that change now with the internet and with everything going on for us?
Oh, yeah. I know physically it's still about the same here in Rockford in regards to venues, but oh, wow. I'm not running out of any venues at all online. And there are more that I can be a part of, but I've pretty much committed myself to at least about 3 of them. And that's enough for me because it takes a lot of energy and time. I was on one today. It's called Angora Poets World Cafe, and it's out of France, out of Paris. And, you know, they last just as long as you being there physically. So it's a lot of energy, a lot of preparation and you're having dialogue in between. There's a lot of venues online, and some I had never heard of until, you know, we had to go online for a lot of this stuff.
Mm-hmm. And how's that for you with the audience reaction? Because I know when we have a slam going on, we got the audience reaction right away. We got a number saying, hey, you did great, you got a 9, or, oh, you sucked really bad, you got a 2 or a 3 here. And now we're all online looking at screens, and we've got our audience out there. How has that impacted your ability to connect with the audience?
Yeah, that's a great question, too. And yeah, so yeah, you're on Zoom and you're seeing all these different screens. I think I've been able to treat it as if I was at a live venue. So, you know, but the difference is too, is when you're performing on Zoom, featuring or whatever, doing an open mic, folks can make comments in a little chat box. So you got people sharing right inside your performance or afterwards. So, you know, it's cool to be able to see that. And then people maybe even send you private messages and they want to follow you or connect in some kind of way. So I'm gotten used to it. It still feels odd because I'm such a very community driven poet where I want to be in front of people, but I've adapted to it and got used to it. So I think I'm treating it as if it was a live open mic somewhere now, or poetry slam or whatever.
Yeah, and with, you know, on the political sense, on the protest sense, you definitely do want to have that connection with the audience as much as you can. You know, if you can be in front of them and leading them, something like that, I can imagine that's the greatest thing. But obviously, we've got, you know, a worldwide pandemic going on right now, so we've got that to consider for ourselves. In each of our safety, our audience member safety and our safety, we want to make sure that everyone is doing what they need to do. Because every time I see you on the internet doing a video, boom, Chris has got the mask going on. You can hear him loud and clear. He's doing his stuff, which is great. So he's promoting promoting that kind of stuff, promoting the health on that. So that's for sure. So with political stuff, that started back in 2003. And it's been going on. You've been kicking it hardcore for the last about 5 years. So what is it that makes it very vital for you to do a political piece, a protest piece?
I know that people, they need it, and I possess a certain gift. So if I can combine creativity and spoken word together, then it's a beautiful thing. And I'm able to say what some people can't in a way that, you know, a lot of people can't. So I'm thankful for that, to have that ability. I'm just trying to capture this moment in time, be a bit of a journalist for these movements that are going on, these injustices that are happening. And it's cool that, you know, if somebody hears a certain piece or reads a certain piece of mine, they know that I've touched on, you know, these current events and have been able to make sense of what's going on too. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the important thing, to make sense of these things.
We're going to go way back before we were born, like Emily Dickinson and those writers back there. A lot of them were writing for themselves to, you know, think that, you know, they'll never be read. They're writing for themselves. For you, what would you say the breakdown is? How much do you rate for you to get some resolution in your life or get some fulfillment in your life versus writing for the audience? Like you said, sometimes you can say something that somebody else can't because of the way that you can craft words maybe more eloquently than what they can do. How much of it is for you? How much is it for the audience? How much is it for the community at large?
Most of it is for the audience and the community. And it's an epiphany. I'm rarely writing pieces for myself right now. I used to set aside time to do that, but now most of it is for the community or an audience. So I don't really get a chance to write for myself right now. Actually, I take that back because, yeah, I just wrote a new book, a manuscript, you know, turn it into a book. So a lot of that stuff is for me, but it's also to entertain and to educate people who don't know much about Rockford or the west side of Rockford. So with this book, I was able to do a lot of that. But I wasn't looking at it like that, but a lot of that stuff was for me because it was for me to capture my childhood and growing up as a teenager and an adult here in Rockford.
Gotcha. And you know what? We grew up same times. A lot of the same times happening. I grew up on the south east side of it, and I do remember the west side going over there and having a lot of friends over there. And then I actually moved on the west side, but I got to go to school on the east side. I got to go to Jefferson because I had started at Jefferson, but I lived over on Riverside Drive up by Northtown Mall. They let me finish off at Jefferson instead of going over to Auburn. So, but that's a whole other story, probably a whole other poem that we could write together and go, you know, because I think we know why that happened. So, but anyhow, so where can people grab your work right now? Where can people go and, you know, grab that book? Because like I said, like I promised you right before we started recording here, I got to give me a copy of that book too. So, where can we go to grab that book at?
If they went to my PayPal account, paypal.me/blessedpoet, they could get it from me that way. They can send me a message and say they want the book. Or folks can hit me up at Facebook, send me a message, and I can send them the link directly to the book.
See, I'm lucky enough to know Chris that I can go right to his Facebook page and go, hey, Chris, hook me up. Come on. Let's go ahead and get this knocked out, which I will do. I always make it a point if I have an artist on and they got something to put out, I make sure that I buy a copy of it and make it happen for them. But I interview them first so that way I'm not swayed. You guys can't say that I'm swayed one way or the other. So that is cool. All right. So, Chris, where do you see stuff going for you in the next 5 years? Because like you said, in the past 5 years, you really – hit hard on this, on the political and protest poetry. What happens in the next 5 years for you?
You know what, Tim? I'm thinking about it. And, you know, it's all good, but I think I'm going to do at least one book combining jazz, coffee, tea, and what else? Maybe the coffee scene, just to delve back into that and kind of take a break from the political protest stuff, because I've written a lot of it. And I don't want to be looked at as just a protest political poetry writer. I want to be, you know, I want people to know that I can write other stuff too. So I might sit myself down and pick back up on some stuff that I was writing even earlier this year that was, and even last year that where I talked about tea, jazz, and coffee, and cafes and all that kind of thing. Make one of those, a book happen in regards to that scene. Rockford is currently vetting for the city of Rockford, the Rockford Public Library, and the Rockford Area Arts Council has gotten down to three candidates for their initial and inaugural Poet Laureate. So they're going to make an announcement in October of who will be Rockford's first Poet Laureate, the city of Rockford's first Poet Laureate. So I might... that might be me. So that will be, I think, a 2-year role. Mm-hmm. So I'll be the ambassador of poetry and, you know, some things literary here in the city. But ultimately, I just told a company out of Chicago was looking at my talent and maybe want to sign me or they be my agents. I want to put together a solo studio album that has the financial the financial and corporate backing that where a poet, somebody like myself who not only writes poems but rhymes and songs, people can see a full fledged project from me that they can buy and see on every music media platform. That I would love to make happen.
Too sweet.
And maybe by in the next 5 years, maybe at the end of that 5 years, people can say, oh, this guy needs to be the United States, U.S. The U.S. poet laureate. So that's a goal, just the same.
Well, we need to vote for somebody that is going to go ahead and make that happen for us too. So we can definitely, we can all definitely be here in November and do our vote and get us a good president that can get you to be the poet laureate in the United States. Not a problem. You know me, if I could vote in Rockford, I'd vote you definitely as poet laureate of Rockford. That is for sure. So thanks. All my people that are listening in Rockford, if you can vote for this, make sure. Christopher Sims, make him your poet laureate. We know him from a long time ago. He is a great poet for sure. Chris, is there anything that we haven't jumped on here that you would like to talk about here for us?
Yeah, and I was in Charlottesville, Virginia, the weekend Heather Heyer was killed during that Unite the Right rally and the protesting that was going on. And I wanted to ask you, Tim, and you might being a representative of your city, your town that you're in now, how did that affect your particular city or that part of D.C., if it did or not?
No, it really did. There were a lot of people upset about it. I'm a transplant. I got to admit, I am a transplant here. I'm from Rockford. I live in Fredericksburg, Virginia. And when that happened, I saw a lot of transplants like myself kind of get together and said, this is not the way to do stuff. Okay, you don't go run over people. You don't do your Unite the Right thing. That doesn't happen. That scared a lot of people because of all the torches and all the stuff that was going on. You know, it reminded a lot of people of Nazi Germany, what happened back then for Kristallnacht and all that kind of stuff. And then when she lost her life by being run over by a car, people in arms about that, because where I live in has a big university, and there's a lot of thought, a lot of people that can think and can research upset about that. And it started a few protests here. Did it get any bigger than people upset doing Facebook flame wars? Not a whole lot of people actually went out of the house and did that. However, with the recent incidents that happened up in Minneapolis, we have had a lot of protests go on within a week of that incident happening with George Floyd up in Minneapolis. And the interesting thing is that people don't remember Breonna Taylor that happened before that. They don't remember Ahmed that happened right before that. But they remember this, and we've been having protests nightly here. Some of them got violent. Some of them got tear gassed. So Charlottesville affected us somewhat, but this last wave of stuff has really affected us a lot. So it's impacted us, and we could definitely use a voice in this area that can bring people together and can and get people to talk about what's happening here. It would be nice. One of our state delegates, Delegate Cole, he's a good guy that has been talking to the youth that are out there protesting. And that's something that I really respect about him. And I've joined up with him and signed up for his alerts and all that kind of good stuff. For myself, I will be honest with you, Chris, I'm a little bit handcuffed. I'm a little bit silenced because of where I work and because of who I work for. I can only do so much. You know me, I go up to the line and sometimes step over the line a little bit. But honestly, I am handcuffed to what I can do, but I can provide support and aid and comfort and wisdom. And so for me, I can write as much as I want. And I can post it on the internet as much as I want. But that's how I can best ally myself with what's going on and protest what's going on and encourage my stepson, my nephew, go out there and do what you need to do. Be safe about it. Be aware of your surroundings, and you know, carry on the fight that way. I have to carry on the fight a little bit differently. Back in the day that you knew me, you know, on a daily basis, you know, I'd probably be the first one to run out and, you know, let's go ahead and fight about it. Let's, you know, carry signs and everything like that. But in these days, got some age behind me, got some responsibilities behind me, got some handcuffs on me that I can't do necessarily what I want to do. But I go around it as much as I can and help out the movement as much as I can that way.
Gotcha, bro.
So yeah. That's a long answer to that. I'm sorry, but that's my answer to that. But thank you for asking that question.
Not a problem, man. Yeah, thank you for that answer.
How did that affect you from, you know, what happened in Charlottesville? How did that affect you?
Yeah, to be honest, Tim, when I got there and we marched on that Saturday. Mm-hmm. I had never seen anything like it, and it felt weird, even being in this country when that was going on. You saw these militiamen walking with these guns, and they looked like soldiers, you know, marching in an army or in a war. So I had never seen that people that focused on thinking that they were losing something and feeling like they needed to protect themselves when nobody was there to harm them at all. So it felt really strange, and it woke me up even some more. So, and then Alvin Jacobs Jr., who's actually from Rockford, just like we are, Alvin was there. Alvin is living in Charlotte, North Carolina. So he found his way there, and he had his camera and he was taking pictures. And I saw his Facebook post. I think it was that Friday night. He said somebody is going to die here, and that's exactly what happened. And he could see it because he had his camera, and he was with Antifa and seeing them clashing with the ultra right there, the neo Nazis there. So he could see it and sense that is what was going to happen, and that's what happened. And I remember I wasn't at that particular scene when that happened, but I was at a church in Charlottesville, and I saw some people come in who had witnessed it, a couple, and their faces were as red as that painting on your wall back there, and they were shook, and I couldn't look at them long because I'm an empath, and had I looked at them even longer, maybe stepped to them to maybe help them in some regard, I would have been just as devastated or distraught. So that whole thing was just—it was madness, man. That's exactly what it was. And I wrote a poem called "I Was in Charlottesville," and I capture everything. You know, you would actually be walking with me, seeing everything that I saw. You know, when you heard or read that poem.
And that's one of the talents that you have, is you can capture that and put the audience right there with you.
Thank you.
That is a unique voice. I mean, way back in the day when I knew you, back in 2006, 2005, you could do that to a room. You could bring a room to absolute silence. You could bring up borders to absolute silence with your stuff.
That was a gift, man. Yeah, a poem like "I Met Her at a Bookstore," which people still request.
Oh, people still talk about that. Yeah. Yeah. People still talk about that. Chris, how do you create more than you consume?
Man, I think, it's been covered in this conversation. I spend a lot of my time on my Mac here, and I'm writing all the time on this thing and creating new connections and networking. So, I've had this laptop since, I think, January. And I've already, you know, written numerous pieces that some pieces people haven't even heard or seen yet. So I spend a lot of time writing, typing, recording videos and that kind of thing. And on the consumption end, we've been grocery shopping and, you know, I might buy some new clothes here and there, but I think I'm spending a lot more time creating than I am consuming, which I try to stay aware of for sure.
Well, folks, we have Christopher Sims, otherwise known as Universal Love, who I knew him way back in the day. We definitely want to thank you for joining us here tonight. Can you leave us with one thought that we can take away and take with us to the next day?
My favorite thing to say is, even if I'm thinking about what I like to say for sure when I'm live or recording a video, is the word peace, P-E-A-C-E. And I learned this from someone on the East Coast, said that peace, you break it down, positive energy always creates elevation. So that's my thought there to share with you all. Yeah, as long as you stay positive and peaceful, it creates elevation within your home, your community, or people you know and love.
And that's a great note to go out on. Chris, thanks for talking with me. It was great to catch up with you. And folks, we will see you next time on Create Art Podcast, where we create more than you consume. We'll see you next time.